Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Julia LaRoche Show. We are joined today by Brian Hirschman. He is the managing partner of Hirschman Capital, and he is someone that I've heard from many of you, the viewers and listeners, that you'd like to see on the show. So I am so pleased to bring to you this conversation. In this episode, Brian explains why this is the most dangerous time that he's ever seen in financial history. He also points to three bubbles that could burst in the next recession, including equities, real estate, and global bonds. He also explains why gold is poised to do well and why he sees gold rising to 7,000. He is a value investor and he plays the gold trade by investing in mining stocks. I really enjoyed this conversation with Brian. I learned a lot and I hope you do too. Brian Hirschman, managing partner at Hirschman Capital. It is so great to welcome you on the show. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me today, Brian.
Thanks, Julia. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm excited to have you on. And I got to say, I see your name all the time in the guest request in the comment section. So I know some of the viewers are going to be really happy to have you on. And I'm excited to introduce you to this audience. And Brian, I would like to start where I always start with my guest, and that is to get their big picture, the macro view of the economy. We can throw markets in there as well. And one of the things about this show, Brian, is you can take all the time you need to set the stage when it comes to the macro picture.
Sure. Thank you. In short, I think this is probably the most dangerous time in U.S. financial history, because this is the first time, and probably the first time in world history, that a major economy has had three very large bubbles all at the same time. And right now we have bubbles in U.S. equities, U.S. real estate, and global bonds. And as we'll probably talk about today, I think all three of those bubbles are likely to burst at the same time. And of course, nobody can predict exactly when three super bubbles are going to end, but I think there's good reasons to think they might end soon. But the good news is that this should be the opportunity of a lifetime for gold investors. But before I talk about the bubbles, I wanted to share a quick analogy that I got from Mark Spitznagel, who Julia spoke about with Nassim Taleb on her show last year. And that is that current U.S. and global economic policy is similar to a discredited firefighting policy. What do I mean by that? Well, for most of the 20th century, forest managers in the U.S. thought that forest fires should be suppressed as soon as they occurred. But they eventually learned that suppressing forest fires is actually a bad idea because it leads to a buildup of tinder and dry brush in the forest, which makes the inevitable forest fire far worse than it otherwise would be. And a tragic example of that was the 1988 Yellowstone fire that was 44 times bigger than any previous recorded fire at the national park. But economic policymakers across the world have not learned the same lesson, because for the last 40 years, we've been zealously suppressing every recession, every minor crisis, with bailouts, with aggressive fiscal deficit spending, with aggressive monetary policy in the form of rate cuts. And just to give some examples from the U.S., we had the rate cuts after the 1987 stock market crash. We had the rate cuts after the 91 recession, the rate cuts after the 2001.com crash, the rate cuts after the as part of the global financial crisis. And we had low rates leading up to COVID as well, to the COVID recession. And it's similar with bailouts. We had the bailouts of the S&Ls in the 1980s. We had the bailouts of the Continental Illinois Bank in 1984, the bailout of Mexico in 94, and the bailout, when we were involved in the bailout of long-term capital management in 1998. So the list goes on and on. And the problem with this is, similar to forest management, always suppressing crises increases the severity of future economic crises, because it encourages reckless behavior by lenders and borrowers. Because if you're a lender or a borrower and you think the government is always going to be there to bail you out, then why not take more risk and lever up? Because the government will always prop up the private sector. And we can see that increased recklessness in the growth of global total debt to GDP, and total debt includes both government and private debt. And for the 100 years leading up to 1980, global total debt to GDP averaged around 125%. But since this era of bailouts has begun, global total debt to GDP grew to around 200% of GDP in 2008. And today it's probably more than 250%. And this crisis suppression policy has also created the U.S. equity bubble, since low rates have forced investors into equities as the Fed has tried to prop up the economy by creating a wealth effect, by propping up the stock market, and aggressive fiscal spending, aggressive deficits have also juiced corporate profits. And if you look at pretty much any valuation metric for U.S. equities that has a reliable good track record of predicting long-term equity returns, it says we're in a bubble right now. You can look at market cap to sales, market cap to GDP, market cap to replacement cost, market cap to cyclically adjusted earnings, which is the average earnings over the prior 10 years. All of those metrics say the market needs to fall around 50% just to get back to a normal valuation. And as we'll probably talk about today, I think it's very, very likely that we'll have an inflation crisis soon in the U.S. And if that happens and U.S. equities return to the cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio that they had during the last inflation crisis, then the valuation of the U.S. stock market would need to decline by around 85%. And it's a similar story in the real estate market, where we've had this aggressive stimulus in the form of rate cuts, which has driven up home prices. And it's incredible to me that the price to rent ratio and the price to income ratio for U.S. residential real estate is now higher than it was in the 2006 housing bubble. And to me, this is a great example of what the economist J.K. Galbraith called the eternal brevity of the financial memory, because investors have forgotten all the lessons from the last housing bubble, even though it was less than 20 years ago. But the key point, I think, is that this age of bailouts is probably over, or is almost certainly over, because all this fiscal stimulus for decades and decades has pushed government's finances to the breaking point. If we take the U.S. as an example, right now we have this toxic combination of high deficits, high government debt to GDP, high inflation, and high borrowing from foreigners. And the high deficits and the high government debt to GDP are a problem because it means our government debt is growing much faster than our capacity to pay, than our ability to pay. And the high inflation is a sign that the U.S. government has already started to default through inflation. And the borrowing from foreigners is a problem because foreign investors tend to be more fickle and they're tougher to control with regulations. And there's a lot of studies that show that countries with a lot of borrowing from foreigners tend to have more debt crises and tend to default sooner. In fact, there's been 21 instances of this combination of these four toxic factors since 1914. And all 21 of those countries defaulted within 2 years, and their median average annual inflation over the subsequent 4 years was 18%. So none of them were able to, in fact, none of them were able to avoid sustained inflation through some central bank policy or through a recession. And one other problem that we have right now is we have a lot of short debt maturities in the U.S., which means we have a lot of refinancing risk, and that's a big reason why our government interest expense is increasing very rapidly. But another very important point is this government debt problem isn't limited to just the U.S. It's a global problem. Global government debt to GDP is near an all-time high, and the government debt level in many countries is at a level that has almost always led to default. Examples of that include Japan, Italy, France, UK, and Brazil. The UK had a mini debt crisis in 2022, which might have been a preview of what's to come, and Brazil had a mini debt crisis less than a decade ago. And so what this means is when we inevitably have a government debt crisis in one country, it could spread across the world due to the globally high government debt levels. And in fact, we could be seeing the beginning of that now, since rates have been steadily rising, interest rates have been steadily rising across the world since 2020. But probably the most important point that I want to get across is that everything is changing, because for the first time in the last four decades, governments will probably be the cause of the next crisis, not the cure. They'll be the source, not the savior. Because if a government is having a debt crisis and it's defaulting through inflation, then if it tries to cut rate cuts, tries to cut interest rates, that just leads to more inflation. Or if it tries to bail out a bunch of banks and a bunch of companies, that should just make the debt crisis worse, because the government would be taking on more liabilities, and that would make investors even more concerned about the government's solvency. So what we might get instead is a doom loop where a government debt crisis causes a private sector recession, which in turn makes the government debt crisis even worse. And we saw examples of that in Greece after its debt crisis roughly 15 years ago. And we're seeing something like that in Argentina right now. And of course, if the US government has a debt crisis, then the valuations of equities and real estate should collapse. And that would be similar to what happened to US equity valuations during the 1970s. When we last had high inflation. But it could also go the other way. If the U.S. housing bubble starts to deflate, then that could cause the U.S. government's budget deficit to explode, and that could precipitate a government debt crisis. And that's similar to what happened in Ireland and Spain 15 years ago. But the difference is that our debt metrics look much worse than theirs did prior to their crises. So to sum it up, I agree with what Jim Rogers said when he was on Julia's show, that the next crisis should be the worst of our lifetime due to the high debt levels. But I would add that the very large asset bubbles will also make the crisis very difficult. But the silver lining is this should be an incredible opportunity for gold investors.
That's a great frame up to the conversation. Real quick, did you say equities would need to decline by, did I hear 85%?
Sure. And that's right now the US cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio, which is market cap relative to the average earnings over the prior 10 years. It's around 34, 35. And when equities were at their low, when they were at their lowest valuation in the 1970s, the cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio was only around 5. So that's around an 85% return. If you were to use other valuation metrics, then you would probably get to a similar number, I think. And so in some ways, that's a little bit of a pessimistic statement because that was the low valuation. But then on the other hand, there's many reasons to think that the next inflation crisis is going to be far worse than the 1970s. For example, in the 1970s, our government debt to GDP is around 40%. And that gave us a lot of flexibility to raise interest rates and the Volcker interest rate hikes, for example. But now our government debt to GDP could soon be above 150% if we have a recession or if interest rates rise. And so there's many reasons to think the next inflation crisis will be much more severe than the 1970s. And so maybe that 5 cape multiple at the low in 1970s isn't so crazy to think about.
Hey there, I hope that you are enjoying listening to this episode. If you can, please take a moment to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcast. And if you could leave us a rating and a review, it would help us so much in continuing to grow the show and bringing some incredible guests for these longer form discussions. Thank you so much for your support, and I hope you enjoy the rest of this episode. Okay, so Brian, I want to hear more on why gold is poised to perform well, but before we go there, can I just get your take on gold today, even gold hitting all-time highs? And the reason I'm curious is, how is it hitting all-time highs when stocks are also hitting record highs, Bitcoin at a record high? It feels like such a perplexing environment. Can you help us understand what is going on with like the markets and especially gold right now?
Yeah, sure. I'll answer that question as part of my answer when I discuss my longer term outlook for gold. And of course, the gold, like any asset class, you need to be careful not to read too much into the day-to-day fluctuations. But one of the things that can affect gold is lower interest rates, because when interest rates fall, that makes gold look more attractive relative to things like money market funds or bank deposits. And recently, because I think the market's become more concerned about the risk of a recession or a slowdown, interest rate expectations, the expectation for lower interest rates has been increasing. And so gold, like crypto and like equities, has been benefiting from that. But that's not the only thing that can affect gold's valuation. For instance, the other two things that have a big impact on gold's valuation are inflation. Inflation reduces the value of fixed payments in the future. So that's a big problem for bond investors, since bonds depend on fixed coupon payments in the future. But gold doesn't decline in value when inflation increases, because it doesn't depend on dividend or coupon payments far in the future. Thus, when you get an inflation crisis, investors tend to shift from assets like bonds to gold. And that effect can be really big, because the value of all the world's debt is around 20 times the value of the world's gold. So if you have just a small shift from bonds to gold, it can cause a huge increase in the gold price. And we saw that happen in the 1970s when inflation increased and gold increased dramatically. The other thing that can increase gold's value is when concern about defaults or increases, which usually happens when risk aversion is also increasing. And of course, increased defaults are generally bad for equities and for many types of bonds. But as the cliche goes, gold is the one asset that is nobody's liability and is thus immune to default. And we saw examples of how gold could benefit from increased concern about defaults in the European debt crisis 15 years ago, and also when we had the mini banking crisis last year and gold popped a little bit. But I think the important thing is that those first two factors are much more important, the concern about inflation and the concern about defaults, because in the 1970s, you often had rising interest rates, which you would think would be bad for gold, but gold actually did incredibly well because the concern about inflation has a much greater impact on gold and led to such a large shift of capital into gold. And then conversely, in the 80s and 90s, you had a diminishing concern about inflation, but you often had falling interest rates, and gold did very poorly then, because again, that concern about inflation is much more important for gold price movements than the fluctuations in interest rates. Although right now we're mostly just seeing seeing gold's price being driven by interest rates, most likely, since inflation expectations have been pretty steady over the last few years. But I think the big point for your listeners is that gold's valuation right now, it's around its 50-year average. And for all the reasons I mentioned earlier, I expect defaults and inflation to increase a lot over the next few years. And that should be incredibly positive for the gold price. In fact, if gold goes back to the same valuation it reached during 1980 at its peak, then it should rise to more than 7,000. That's a peak valuation. So if gold was at 7,000, I would have probably sold all my gold mining investments by that point. But as I mentioned earlier, there are many reasons to think that the next inflation crisis will be much worse than the 1970s. So perhaps gold will go much higher this time.
Even higher than the 7,000 that you think it could go to? Or?
Yeah, the 7,000 is assuming gold returns to the same peak valuation it was at in 1980. So that would be, and so it would then be well above its historical average. And so I certainly wouldn't be buying it at that point. But yeah, I mean, there's many reasons to think inflation this time around is going to last for much longer. As I was alluding to earlier, the government isn't going to be able to hike interest rates the way it did in around 1980 to lower inflation expectations, because if it did that, it would literally default outright because our government debt is so much higher. And also leading into the 1970s inflation crisis, we didn't have these huge asset bubbles in equities and real estate that we have now. And also our corporate debt and our consumer debt is far higher now. And so for all those reasons, I think the next inflation crisis could make the great inflation from 1965 to 1982 look relatively mild. But again, that should be incredible for gold investors.
Okay. All right. So I want to hear more on the thesis around inflation, because so the Fed's policies right now, the rate hikes, is it just futile at this point? Or are they making a mistake, or is there just not much they can do? I just want to hear more on maybe your views on the Fed policy decisions and this thesis on like more pervasive inflation, because sometimes you see headlines that like we're going to beat inflation or inflation's like coming down. Just want to get your perspective.
Yeah, I think my perspective is a little bit different, because of course, when you talk to almost any Wall Street strategist or any broker, they're very, very focused on what is the Fed going to do. But I don't think for a long-term gold mining investor, I don't think it matters that much. Ultimately, the Fed is going to be trapped. And this was similar to what you were talking about with Professor Calamiris a few weeks ago. Ultimately, the Fed will be trapped and will lose control of interest rates, because if the U.S. government is having a debt crisis, inflation will be very high. And then if the Fed lowers interest rates, that would just cause more inflation. And if the Fed raises interest rates, then that'll just make the government's debt problem even worse. And that would also lead to more inflation. And so ultimately, we're heading for a situation where the Fed is trapped. And I think when investors are very focused on what the Fed is going to do, they still have this crisis suppression mentality where they think the government's always going to save them and they need the Fed to save them. And so they're very focused on that. But that's missing the point I was trying to make earlier, that we're heading into this regime where everything is going to change because government debt is at the breaking point. And so, yeah, they're a bit, investors are a bit like junkies that are kind of addicted to these bailouts that they have been getting for the past few decades through Fed rate cuts. And so we're kind of heading into an environment where instead of a Fed put, what people have been accustomed to, you're going to get a Fed margin call, where the government debt problem forces interest rates up and causes the private sector to sell assets and try to reduce debts.
Got it. Okay. So let me ask you this too, on this notion of a U.S. government debt crisis and a potential for default. Some might say, you know, we have the our currency, the U.S. dollar is like the global reserve. Couldn't that insulate us? And why is that argument incorrect?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, because I think that's the most common argument that I hear as to why the U.S. government isn't going to have a debt crisis. And the answer is pretty simple. Before the last inflation crisis that I've been referring to from 1965 to 1982, the U.S. dollar was even more of a reserve currency than it is now. For instance, in 1975, 85% of central bank reserves were U.S. dollars. Today, that's only around 58%. But despite our reserve currency status then, that didn't prevent that inflation crisis. And interest rates got all the way to 16% in 1981. So it seems highly unlikely that our diminished reserve currency status today is going to prevent the next government debt crisis. And you can also see that in the ownership data for U.S. Treasuries. Foreign ownership of U.S. Treasuries has been steadily declining since 2014, and that's the exact opposite of what you would expect to see if there was this huge demand for Treasuries because of the U.S. dollar's reserve currency status.
Got it. And you mentioned Professor Charles Calamiris, who was on the show in December for the folks who are watching and listening. I'll link to that episode in the show notes. And he was talking about, you know, moving to fiscal dominance. And it sounds like you watched the episode, and I'm sure you've read his paper that was published with the St. Louis Fed. How might gold be impacted if we saw the scenario that Dr. Calamirs painted as relates to like moving more into fiscal dominance? And he also talked about like an inflation tax as well.
Yeah, that I would definitely encourage people to check out Julia's episode with Professor Calamirs. It was one of my favorites. The short answer is I think the scenario he was describing, fiscal dominance and zero interest reserves, should be fantastic for gold. And I'll give a quick explanation of some of his ideas, and you can check out that episode for a more thorough explanation. But, and I haven't spoken to Professor Calamirs, but I think he would agree that U.S. government is unsustainable and that it's just a matter of time before the U.S. government defaults through sustained high inflation. And I think he would also agree that this is a global problem. And so when that happens to the U.S., it's also likely going to be happening to many other governments across the world. And he also mentioned the fiscal dominance issue that Julia mentioned, and that is just what I was describing earlier. Ultimately, the U.S. government will have a debt crisis, and that will cause the Fed to be trapped, because if it lowers rates, that'll just increase the inflation problem that we will already be having in the debt crisis. And if they raise rates, then that might cause more inflation also, because it'll make the government's debts grow even faster. Or as I mentioned before, it might cause the government to default outright because our debt levels are so much higher than when Paul Volcker was chairman of the Fed. And that essentially means that the government debt problems will dominate the Fed. Hence, they use the term fiscal dominance. But one of the other interesting things that Professor Calamirs talked about is that when inflation is high during the debt crisis, say 10% per year, the Fed is going to use bank reserve requirements to force banks to lend to the U.S. government at a 0% interest rate, which would mean that banks are losing 10% of their investments each year because they would be lending at 0% when inflation was 10%. But that'll be good for the government, of course, because it'll lower its borrowing cost and thereby improve the deficit. That also means that banks, to avoid going bankrupt, will have to cut the amount of interest they pay depositors to 0%, probably, because banks won't be getting any interest income from their loans to the government. And that means depositors would also be losing around 10% of their investments each year because they would be getting no interest and inflation would be 10%. As a result, since gold is one of the few assets that can be held outside of the U.S. financial system or outside of the global financial system, there would probably be a huge, and this would probably be going, these policies would probably be implemented by governments across the world, not just the U.S. So this would be, this a negative 10% interest rate would be a global problem. So gold would probably soar as investors shifted from deposits to gold. And right now, the value of all the world's deposits is around 10 times the value of the world's gold. So if you saw 10% of those deposits shift to gold, that would result in a doubling of the gold price. If you saw 30%, that would result in a 300% increase in the gold price.
Yeah. Okay. So when it comes to gold, you mentioned earlier that you invest in gold mining companies. I want to hear a couple of questions. Like, Why play it with the gold mining companies? And can you share a bit about how that works exactly, how they kind of make their money? Why is that a more attractive way to express an investment in gold?
Sure. So I think gold bullion is, it's also a good investment. And historically, it's reduced portfolio volatility. And I expect that to continue going forward for all the reasons we've discussed. But two of the issues I have with gold bullion, which include physical gold and the gold ETFs, is that its long-term historical inflation-adjusted return is only around 1%, whereas the historical inflation-adjusted return for global equities is probably around 5%. So over the next 30 years, I would expect gold bullion to underperform. The second issue is that although I think gold valuation is around its historical 50-year historical average right now. It's not overvalued. It's also not especially undervalued, which means if the bubbles don't burst for another few years, gold might not do much until that happens, although I would still expect it to do very well when we inevitably have a crisis. And so that leads me to the gold miners. I prefer the gold mining equities that my funds invest in for a couple of reasons. One is if the gold price soars, then the gold mining equities should vastly outperform gold bullion due to operating leverage. And by operating leverage, I mean that if you have a gold mine with a 50% profit margin and then gold rises 10%, the profits of the gold mine would increase by 20%. And then you'd expect the gold mining equity to go up much more than the gold price by around 20%, perhaps. And that operating leverage effect can be really powerful. Right now I have companies in my portfolio that are trading around $25 per gold ounce, which means gold that they have in the ground, but they haven't yet dug it out of the ground. They haven't yet mined it. And if the gold price goes to that $7,000 price that we're talking about earlier, then many of those companies might trade for more than $800 per gold ounce. So that would be an astronomical return, of course. And then if the gold price doesn't go anywhere, a lot of the companies in my portfolio, they're trading for around 30% of the present value of their future cash flows at current gold prices. So I'd expect if the gold price is flat, that the equities would still appreciate as their valuations improve and move closer to the present value of their future cash flows. And then, of course, the most important thing is what happens if the gold price falls. And if that happens, I would probably expect the gold mining equities to decline more than the gold price. But I would think that would just be temporary. I would expect that to just be temporary because their valuations are very low and their production costs are low and they have conservative capital structures. And then ultimately, when the gold price soars for all the reasons we've discussed, I would expect them to rebound dramatically. So I think the gold mining equities are the better risk return, but they're really more appropriate for a long-term investor, because they can fluctuate much more than gold bullion in the short term. And then another option for investors would be the gold mining ETFs, such as the GDX and the GDXJ. I prefer my fund because it's outperformed over the last 9 years, and the valuations of the companies in the gold mining ETF tend to be higher because it's restricted in the companies it can buy, and it can't buy a lot of the smaller companies that my fund invests in. And it also tends to have more exposure to a lot of higher risk developing countries like China, where I don't want to own a gold mine.
Got it. Okay, so going back to the three bubbles that you shared, and they're on this path where they could burst. My kind of question for you, Brian, is who will get impacted the most? Because I look at real estate, I'm a millennial, I have a great job. I feel like I've done all the right things. I would love to own a house. And I personally, I feel like kind of priced out, or it feels so ridiculous, like some of these prices that I'm like, I'm kind of like hoping for a major pullback in housing. I know that's kind of selfish to say, or even like, I don't know, equities or whatever. Do you have a point of view on like who could get impacted the most, or what could it create an opportunity down the road for an entry point for folks to get in?
Yeah. And it's a bit more of an asset allocation question. So it's not really my day job, but I'm happy to share my thoughts. I think we can start with bonds. I think long-term bonds would get crushed, which is probably why medium-term bonds also by high inflation, since they're not, their coupon payments are fixed and not indexed to inflation, which is why you've heard guys like Buffett advise people not to invest in long-term bonds. U.S. equities would be very vulnerable because the valuations, for the reasons we discussed earlier, the valuation of the U.S. equity market is very high, and we would expect that to get crushed just like it did during the last inflation crisis. I think the valuations of international equities in places like Brazil and the UK are much better, and there's good reasons why the US dollar is overvalued right now, and so that also makes the foreign equities look more attractive. Just look at how much cheaper a vacation to Japan is now compared to what it was 10 years ago. And you can get a sense for why I think the US dollar is overvalued. And so I would expect international equities, foreign equities, to do better than U.S. equities in this crisis. Certainly Brazil and the U.K. and Japan have their issues, but those equity markets, I would think, would decline less and bounce back sooner simply because the valuations are much better there. And then as far as real estate, I think if somebody was able to lock in a 30-year mortgage at 2%, then they might do pretty well because although the value of their home, the price-to-rent ratio of their home will compress, the value of their mortgage will also potentially get wiped out by inflation. And then for somebody that is looking to buy real estate, yeah, I think what might happen is mortgage rates will go up and price to rent ratios will come down. And so the price of homes will fall down, will decline. They'll be able to get in at a lower price. The mortgage rate will be much higher, but then hopefully in future decades, they'll be able to refinance that mortgage and get a better rate. So I do think if you're deciding between renting and buying, it's probably better to rent. Right now, I think I'm near Los Angeles. And right now, I think the median home buyer in someone with a median income in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. if they would like to buy a home with the median home price, they will need to spend 85% of their income on the mortgage, which means if home prices go up a little bit more or if interest rates go up a little bit more, they would need to spend 100% of their mm-hmm. income on their mortgage. And I think we can all agree. I think we can all agree that that's not sustainable. And that's the case. At the same time, unemployment is soaring in California and people are leaving California. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. But I would not be buying in Los Angeles at the moment.
Yeah, it will be interesting. You mentioned at the top of this conversation when you opened that this is the most dangerous time in financial history, and you pointed to the three bubbles. So my question for you, Brian, is there anything that would change your thesis or anything that can be done to ameliorate the situation from where you sit? What could be done to kind of get us off this path that you see?
Yeah, it's a great question. Before I make any investment, you always write down what are the things that might change my thesis and make me reevaluate this investment. And on a macro level, one of the things I always write down, well, if the U.S. government starts paying down its debt and reducing its debt to GDP, then that kind of changes the situation. But I think if we can all agree, the probability of that is close to zero. We haven't run a budget surplus since the dot-com bubble in 2000. And it's pretty clear that nobody in Washington will have much interest in reducing the debt until the crisis has already begun. And by then it'll probably be too late. And that's why countries like the pigs in Europe, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, and Spain weren't able to get out of their crises on their own. They needed a bailout because once you start implementing austerity, when you're already having the crisis, that it makes your GDP goes slower because you're raising taxes and cutting government spending, and that causes your debt to GDP ratio to increase. And so that's why it's very hard to, almost impossible to get out of these, potentially impossible to get out of these situations once you get to the 150% debt to GDP, government debt to GDP ratio that we might be at soon. So that's really the one I watch out for. I also, and it seems like it's pretty unlikely, but it's something to monitor.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I was reading on your website, Brian, when you first launched Hirschman Capital in 2014, Value Walk, which is it's a blog focused on hedge funds, they called you the most bearish hedge fund. I think that was the moniker you got. And some might listen to you and say, you're pretty bearish, I suppose. What are you upbeat on? What are you kind of bullish on or positive on these days?
Yeah, I think gold, which we've touched on, I think it's I'm probably the most bullish I'll ever be on gold. I think
I'll tell you, they love gold in the comment section, so come to the right place.
Right. I hope so. And international equities, I do think the valuations are more reasonable there. And in addition, there's nothing wrong with keeping cash, but I think U.S. equities, very expensive. U.S. real estate, very expensive. Global bonds, very expensive. And it is a very dangerous time. I mean, you look at 1929, we had the stock market bubble that led to the Great Depression. That was just one bubble because we had no real estate bubble then, and we had no government debt issues then, and that contributed to the Great Depression. You look at the Japanese asset price bubble in 1989, where they had a real estate bubble and a stock market bubble. Those bubbles were much bigger than our current bubbles, but they didn't have a government debt problem. And that still led to a lost decade for Japan, and their real estate and their equity markets still have not gotten back to their 1989 peaks after adjusting for inflation more than 30 years later, which shows how severe the consequences can be when you have two bubbles at the same time, let alone the three that we have right now. And then 2008, we had the housing bubble. That was just one bubble, since government debt was lower then, and the equity market was more reasonably priced. And that still almost led to a depression in the U.S. and the world. So this is a very dangerous situation. So there's some things I'm bullish on, but not a lot.
Yeah. I don't even know if we've mentioned it here, or I don't think I even asked you, but your base case for a recession, I take it you think there's a recession coming based on this conversation. Do you have like an outlook as it relates to recession? Any sort of, I know it's so hard to do timing, but if you have that, anything you can share there on the recession front?
Yeah, I think recessions, of course, are very difficult to predict, but I do think a recession is likely. And if we do get one, I think that would probably pop all three bubbles, since it would crush corporate profits and it would reduce demand for homes and lead to some forced home sales. And I think it would be potentially a disaster for the U.S. government's finances. In fact, I recently did an analysis where I looked at how much recent recessions in the U.S., such as the dot-com bubble and the global financial crisis and the COVID recession, I looked at how much they increased the government deficit. And if we assume the next recession has a similar impact, then that means U.S. government debt to GDP would probably increase from around 122% now to around 145% of GDP. And that's assuming no increase in interest rates. If we had an increase in interest rates due to the high debt levels, then it would be even uglier, maybe 160% or something like that. And even assuming no increase in interest rates, the government budget deficit would probably go from around 6% per year to around 13% of GDP per year. And that's a problem, because if you look at all the other countries since 1991 that have had government debt to GDP of at least 110% and budget deficits of at least 11%, all of them defaulted within 2 years. So I think if we do get that recession, it's highly likely to cause a government debt crisis. And then as far as why I think a recession is likely, I think there's three categories of metrics that have predicted the last eight recessions with no false positives. And they're all indicating right now that we're heading into a recession. And for me, that's enough to say that a recession is likely. The first is the inverted yield curve, which Julia discussed a lot with Kim Harvey, so I won't go into detail about that. The second is the Conference Board's leading economic indicators. But really the third category of indicators that I think is most interesting is the employment market, because as Julia also talked about with Claudia Sahm, 70% of the economy is consumption. So if you get a spike in unemployment, then that's going to cause people to cut back on spending, and that almost certainly will lead to a recession. And right now, we've seen the unemployment rates increasing the trend in the unemployment increasing for the last 7 months. It's been substantially above its 12-month moving average for this last 7 months. And when that's happened in the past, it's always led to a recession. And also, if you look at labor market metrics such as job hires, job openings, part-time workers, temporary workers, average hours, all of those metrics are heading in the wrong direction. And when they've been weakening as much as they have been, we've always gotten a recession in the past. And so that's why I think a recession seems likely. But I think really the most important point is if you're a long-term gold mining investor, it doesn't matter that much if a recession, whether the recession happens in 2024 or 2026, inevitably we'll get a recession. Inevitably the bubbles will burst. All past bubbles have burst. And so at some point, gold is going to soar. In the meantime, the sorts of gold mines that I invest in, they should continue to appreciate as they produce cash and they discover more gold and they make progress permitting their mines and things like that.
Yeah. Well, I got to say, Brian, I appreciate that you listened to the show. So thank you so much for all the plugs. And I've really enjoyed having you on. I want to give you the final few minutes here, Brian, to, you know, one, share more about your firm and the work that you're doing there and let folks know where they can find your work. And also, let's leave the audience with some parting thoughts, something that maybe we didn't bring up in this conversation. Or if you want to go back and reemphasize something, the floor is yours.
Yeah, I think if I don't tweet much, but you can follow me on Twitter at HCapitalLLC, all one word. And my hedge fund's website is hcapital.llc. And I certainly appreciate everyone listening. I think, and yeah, hopefully I've given you some good questions to discuss with your financial advisor or with your family office, whatever the situation might be. If they have you in a lot of long-term bonds, you know, you can ask, why are we invested in these when we're getting paid very little and the probability of U.S. defaults is close to 100%? Or why am I heavily invested in U.S. equities when all the valuation ratios that have done a good job of predicting past crises are saying that the equity market is extremely, extremely overvalued? Why am I not monetizing more of my U.S. real estate investments if real estate is at an all-time high valuation? Why don't I have exposure to gold if the probability of a global debt crisis has never been higher? I think those are all good questions to ask. And yeah, so I would just reemphasize what we've been talking about here. And I look forward to keeping everyone posted because I think the next few years should be interesting.
Well, Brian Hirschman, Managing Partner at Hirschman Capital, thank you so much for being so generous with your time and all of your ideas. I really appreciate you taking the time to come on today.
Thank you.